And welcome to another edition of Stormy Weather, news from the front line in the end times. I'm very delighted this week to present a chat that I've had with Neil Kramer, The Cleaver. The website there is thecleaver.blogspot.com. Neil is someone whose work I've been aware of for quite some time without actually really looking into it in any depth, but it's a link that pops up just about everywhere you go within this community, so he's definitely had quite a following for quite some time now, but our paths haven't crossed until now. And Neil and I went very deep into many different areas, as you'll see. And once again, it was a 2-hour chat, so I'm breaking the conversation into two parts, and the next part will be up following Wednesday. I'm trusting that you'll find this is every bit as scintillating and stimulating as I did. Neil Kramer, welcome to Stormy Weather.
Well, thank you for having me here. It's good to join you.
I was listening to your interview with Henrik on Red Ice. The description that you made of your experience in Glastonbury with the polarity and the bifurcation of consciousness that you were describing, because it's something that I hardly ever hear about. It's something that I've observed for a long time, and I've tried to express it to people, but I've always had a hard time because there's this very sort of shiny, happy New Age view that we're all ascending and we're all, you know, awakening, and that consciousness is rising in the species, whereas my experience, in a sense, has been the opposite. And so your description was very, as I say, it was very refreshing. And it was very similar to something that I'd heard recently on a tape from this teacher called John DeRuta, who speaks at the College of Integrated Philosophy. He's a guru. He's here in Canada. And I was listening to a tape just a couple of days before I was listening to your interview, where he talked about the presence of truth in the world, and that the stronger the presence of truth becomes in the world, the more people resonate with truth, the more that those who are in untruth, the deeper they have to go into untruth. So in a sense, the stronger the presence of truth in the world, the stronger the resistance of the untruth becomes.
Yeah, they seem to be equal and opposite, don't they?
Yeah, well, it's almost like I think you described it this way with your metaphor of the airplane. It's almost like a physical cause and effect thing, that I guess it's as simple as an essential phenomenon, which is the awakening of truth, or kundalini, or however you want to see it, with the corresponding reaction to it, almost like the wave and the undertow. The bigger the wave, the bigger the pull, the stronger the pull of the undertow. And that's very much been my observation, and even my experience to some extent in the world, is that the more certain individuals do resonate with truth, the greater the resistance becomes to that, and so the greater the split between the two areas of attention, if you will, consciousness.
Yeah, well, it sounds like you've just pulled a thought out of my head. I couldn't have put it better myself.
Yeah, well, you're about the only person that I know who's spoken about this, at least in this in that particular field that we're in. And the reason I brought it up now, it actually sounds like we've started, but I didn't mean to do that on you. But the reason I brought it up before anything else was because I was curious about whether this concept of the polarity consciousness, whether that relates to your blog and the name of it, The Cleaver.
No.
Okay.
It could do. It's like one of those things that maybe outside of time, maybe that is the choice, and that is where things were going in a kind of four-dimensional way. It reaches back and says, yeah, that is why it's called that. So it is about duality, it is about cutting through things and so on, but the polarity thing is really something that's necessarily presented itself without any option to ignore it in the last 2 years of my life. So it's something I've been just slowly conscious of, but it really surfaced and was unavoidable. So that's something I've talked about quite a few times now.
So moving on, in the email I sent you, I described to you, explained to you pretty much this, the template I have for Stormy Weather episodes, and You were happy just to. You haven't even seen the questions, is that right?
No, I've no
You
idea what they are.
have. Right.
Nope.
So you have every
I might regret this,
confidence
but it
about
should
that.
be entertaining at least.
Yeah, I think so. But before we embark upon this journey, discovery, do you want to tell the listeners something about yourself and about your blog so that they can find out more about you?
Sure, yeah. Well, basically, I'm a blogger. If you want to use a more dignified term, a writer, but blogger's cool with me. I've had a blog called The Cleaver for around, I don't know, 2 or 3 years now. I think it started up in the middle of 2006 or thereabouts. Done various podcasts, done some speaking engagements, working on a book, doing an audio project at the moment, and doing a megalith project at the moment as well. So anybody who's familiar with my blog will be aware of that. For those who aren't, if you just go to thecleaver.blogspot.com, you get the idea pretty quick. So I'd say, I'm the mercurial blend of mystic and metaphysician, sorcerer and self-indulger. So, take your pick.
Is it psychedelic self-indulger? Is that what you're referring to
Yeah,
there?
that'll do. That's cool, yeah. No, I don't know what that means, but it sounds good.
So, what is a megalith, briefly?
A megalith is basically an old stone. So it's something that's pretty common on the UK landscape, and there seems to be a definite concentration of them in various areas such as Anglesey and Derbyshire and Wiltshire and Somerset in the UK. And these things are pretty ubiquitous, really. But most people envisage perhaps Stonehenge or Avebury and little else, but actually they're all over the place. And when one has a walk round and discovers them and looks at them in the immediate environment, you find that many of them have been built upon by churches, strangely enough. So anybody interested in kind of dragon lines and energy lines and vortices and so on, there's a lot to get into there. So although a lot of geologically minded people have gone quite into this, my angle is slightly different, and it's a little bit more entheogenic, if I dare say, and a bit more intuitive. So I'm not necessarily doing a study as such that I would want to present a paper on. It's more an encounter, I would use that word, is probably more accurate. So the results of that I'm going to release towards the end of the year as a disc with audio and video and some photographs and so on. So one becomes aware when you blog that a lot of the audience is very international, and you forget that. So most people are never going to see stone circles and dolmens and a lot of these sites that appear. Nobody will get a chance to see it. So this is the next best thing to get a feel for it.
So what's that word entheogenic that you just used? Don't think I've heard that one before.
Okay, an entheogen is basically a more botanically flavored word for a psychedelic.
Okay. Gotcha.
So a lot of people who follow people like Terence McKenna and so on towards the late 90s, towards the end of his life, he started to slip into that word a little bit. And now, if you see any contemporary shamanic writings, particularly by sort of the more popular people like Daniel Pinchbeck and stuff, he'll drop that word left, right, and center. And I suppose if you're one of the new generation, anybody under sort of 60 really, it's not as loaded with the baggage of psychedelic. So if I said entheogen to my mother, she wouldn't, kind of worry about it. If I said psychedelic, she'd probably, drop the dishes.
Okay, well, let's press on. We're just looking for one word answers with these. So whatever comes into your
Okay.
head, yeah? The less you think about it,
Yeah,
probably the
sure.
better for everyone. What quality do you like
Yeah,
about
do it.
yourself the most?
Presence, as in being present.
What quality do you like the least?
If it was in an interview for a job, I'd say being a perfectionist, but that simply isn't true because I don't care. Indifference.
What about others? What quality do you like in others?
Sincerity. Warmth.
And what do you like least in other people?
Posturing.
What's your favourite word today?
Dirigible.
Dirigible. Is that like a form of vehicle or something
Yeah, it's
like
like a
that?
Zeppelin.
Right. What's your least favourite word today?
Credit crunch.
What's your earliest memory?
My earliest memory is lying on my back in a cot playing with a plastic toy, you know, like one of those mobile things.
What's your favourite smell?
Smoke from a bonfire.
I thought you were going to say from a bong for a minute there.
No, not right now, no.
Okay. What's your idea of heaven?
Flying unaided, as we do in dreams.
And what's your idea of hell?
Being consumed by mind.
Yeah, I can relate to that. Okay, so those are 10 questions.
Okay.
To you personally, to everyone listening, if there's anyone has any ideas or suggestions about more variations on these questions, I was just looking for a very simple intro, and it's kind of like to get a sort of personal profile summed up in a very short period of time was the idea behind
Yeah.
these. So, yeah, if you have any ideas about other questions that might be appropriate, let me know. Okay, so now we've got questions for the end times. As you know, there's 64 of these questions. I've tried to make each of them as sort of in depth and as, I guess you could say, abstract, as non-leading as possible. They're on subjects ranging from sorcery to conspiracy to alien abduction to reincarnation, death. You name it, pretty much the whole gamut of the things that I know that both of us are interested in. So I don't know how you want to do this, but essentially I just need a number to start with between 1 and 64. And if it turns out that it's a question that you've got absolutely nothing to say about, then just say nothing and just give me another number and we'll just proceed in that
Okay.
spirit.
Okay, 10.
Question number 10, this is something that I know that you're interested in. Psychedelics.
Ha, okay.
Are they a valid tool for awakening gnosis? And what are the drawbacks, if any?
Yes, they are, and there's no question about that. And I feel that anybody who thinks that the only path to heightened awareness is through slog and hard work and massive amounts of Zazen, then they're wrong. So I think what the entheogen, what the psychedelic gives you, is the opportunity to do what I kind of think of as a radical tuning, in that the if you imagine the laser of consciousness as always on a certain frequency, taking various entheogens will turn that dial. And from just a quick overview of these things, geographically, we all have our own entheogens. So here in Europe, it's really the mushroom, certainly in in England. If you're in, South America or the jungles, Belize, Guatemala, etc., you may be talking about ayahuasca. If you're in the deserts of Mexico, it could be peyote, etc. And I think there's a sense in using geographically and what is near you, because there's some sort of cultural string within that that brings the right kind of symbol set and lexicon to you in the altered state. So I think if I leapt out of here tonight from my home in the UK and went to Peru and sat in a backwater with a curandero, it'd be like looking out of a train that's traveling at 1,000 miles an hour with much of the landscape too difficult to distinguish, whereas the psilocybin mushroom, for example, is paced better and is slower and more geographically anchored, if you like, if that makes sense. So I think that these things offer an alternative mode of consciousness, and they're to be, approached in a sacred manner. they're here for our use. You can, as one sort of podcaster puts it, stumble over yourself backwards into a revelation or an epiphany, even if you're just doing this for a laugh. But generally, it seems that the entities and the mindset and the being that permeates these states is more empathetic to those who come with intent and integrity and a certain level of respect.
Yeah, that's definitely been my experience. I was actually thinking about this just this morning, just like an hour ago. I was thinking about my ex thinking back to my experiences on psychedelics, are some of the most transformative and annihilating experiences. For example, do you have any experience of Salvia divinorum?
Yes, I do actually. It's funny you say that. It's still freely available in the shops over here in the UK. So, one of my colleagues was exploiting that situation recently, and we were discussing it. And I was doing some research for him that Daniel Siebert carried out. I don't know if you've heard of him.
No.
Think he's one of the guys who was responsible for extracting Salvinorum, which is the sort of active ingredient, which is, it's unusual because it's not quite like other tryptamines. And he's, he said of all the things, even DMT, this is to be approached with caution because it seems to be available in anything from kind of 5 strength to 60 strength, I believe, which is an enhanced herbal variety of it. So I think in its raw state, it's leaves that you chew, and it's quite a gentle onset, and it's quite a harmonious effect. Whereas if you go onto certain video sites on the internet and type in salvia, you'll just see 14-year-olds in high school falling down the back of the settee because they're doing it for a trip, and it's very, very ugly and very awful. And of course, these are the things that get picked up on. So, yeah, it's interesting. It's one of the few things that's freely available that is completely natural, and you can walk into a shop and buy it in, Chester High Street. Yeah, so it's one of those things that people haven't kind of cottoned onto yet. Experience-wise, I think that the sensations and textures of it are different to some of the other tryptamines, as I say. So it is different. I've not quite formulated my opinions on it yet. So one lady who corresponds with me through my blog, she's kind of been pushing me toward doing a piece on it, because not many people are actually writing about it. It's quite rare. The nearest I've seen is there is a book by a guy, I forget his name now, about his experiences with it, and he said even more than the mushroom with this this herb, and the name derives from the divinus sage Salvia divinorum. It has a distinct communication in that the beings on the other side seem very, very real, dependent on yourself, will depend on how they transform and present themselves, but irrespective of your belief system and quite independent of your state of mind, their presence is kind of indisputable more than anything else, and that's the thing that touches people. Whereas if you've taken 60 strength, it's a blur. If you take 5 strength, it's manageable. I don't know if you've had personal experience, but that's what I've found.
Well, I've never tried. I only even just found out there was such thing as 60 strength. Actually, this moment, I'd heard
Know it's
about
bonus.
it's insane. Yeah, I'd heard about 40 strength, and now I've found out the 60 strength. But I'd only ever tried the 10 times strength extract. I had the 5 and the 10 times extract, and yeah, the 10 was certainly adequate. And I used or experimented with Salvia divinorum regularly for a period of months. I would do it once a week, pretty much. And Yeah, my experiences. It finally took me to a place when I combined the use of marijuana with salvia, as in smoked salvia, while I was already open from smoking marijuana. That took me to a place that I wasn't really ready to go to, you might say, which is kind of like
Yes,
the
indeed, yeah.
it's like I was talking about with Jake Kotze. You know, you only find out what's enough by finding out what's more than enough. But I left salvia alone after that. Basically, I haven't been back to it since then because I felt like not, that I'd I don't know about learned everything it had to teach me, but that it was going to take me a long time to process and fully
And
understand.
what were your findings and your sort of conclusions about it? You know, because you're an articulate guy, it might be good to hear your thoughts on it too.
Well, it's certainly an area where my ability to articulate begins to fail me, I have to say, with Salvia divinorum. I was
It's very state specific, isn't it?
it really does test one's abilities to describe or explain or express experience, because it takes one. See, my experience was not that it took me out of myself, but that it took me deeper into myself. And I did experience entities, but not in the DMT sense of a visual encounter with entities that were outside of oneself. On the contrary, it was non-visual, first of all. I mean, there was a visual element to it, but that was definitely just, it felt as though I was sort of translating an experience that was beyond the sensory into terms that I could understand, including certain visual impressions, colors, and shapes. But essentially, it was definitely non-sensory. And yeah, the experience I had repeatedly, and each it was like each time I smoked, it picked up on the last time in a sense, and I was back in this place and back with these beings, and each time was this incredible sense of recognition and familiarity as I let go of the fear, because there was always a great deal of fear before smoking, of
Yes.
having to let go and lose control. And then as I let go of that, as I let go of the fear, then I found myself once again in this realm, and I remembered that there was nothing to fear here. On the contrary, that this was my true natural state. And but how I interpreted it, perhaps not during, because there wasn't really a rational faculty operating during to speak of, but afterwards, coming out of it, my understanding was that I was actually interacting as consciousness with the molecules of my physical body, and that these molecules were living entities who were communicating with me through singing and laughter, and that they were essentially, that I was remembering that I was a collective, that I was a collective of intelligences, all interacting, and that my personal ego self was illusory, and that once I let go of it, I entered into this sort of fractal wonderland of electric ecstasy, which was completely annihilating, but at the same time, completely liberating. So yeah.
I was just going to say that the interesting thing about, well, if you just take your description, if you just snapshot that description you just gave, it makes me wonder what happens to the psyche of a 13-year-old Californian girl if she does that and experiences that self same thing, but doesn't have the state of mind and doesn't have the serenity to process that. So going back to your original question, it depends, of course, on your processes and your state of mind and the amount of work you've put into developing and clarifying and deepening yourself. So not from some kind of esoteric Gnostic perspective, just from becoming at peace with yourself. So I'm sure that any sort of psychonautic explorer will be familiar with set and setting and so on. And for me, what precedes that always is my own peace. And from day to day, we get a sense of these things in ourselves. And someday you wake up and you know that it's not the day. And other days you may be unpeaceful but full of joy and happiness, but quite vulnerable in a way. So I think it becomes obvious as you become more in tune with your experiences that some days are better than others. And they seem to be relatively random. And you may be able to get astrological pointers, but it's almost like a kind of biorhythm, and you can chart these things and say this is a good 3 days for me to do this. After that, I'm going to have to wait 20 days. That's what I've found.
Right. Well, I never really wanted to smoke salvia. That was the thing, and it baffles my mind that it's become recreational. I find that almost incomprehensible, because,
It's not really recreational, is it now?
well, no, and it's essentially there's something terrifying about that complete loss of control. But I suppose, as you're saying, if people haven't gone into that deeper, subtler realm of being already, then they're not relinquishing control. They're actually trying to handle the experience and use it in a way that is recreational. And I think that the toll that takes is probably extreme. I mean, for example, the period that I'm describing, I was, as I say, using it every week for several months. And during that period, there was a
Wow.
I don't know how many times in total, but maybe 20 times in a short period, I would have smoked it, until that final time that convinced me that that was enough. But during that period, I visited a dentist and had my teeth cleaned and everything else, and then I was suffering teeth problems about 2 months later, and so pain or what have you. And so I went back to another dentist, and he told me that I had six cavities that needed filling. And I told him that I had just seen a dentist 2 months ago, and he'd given me a complete makeover, check over. And so how was it possible that I had developed six cavities during a period of 2 months? And he told me straight out that that wasn't possible. He simply didn't believe me. And I can only deduce from that, seeing as it doesn't stand to reason that the previous dentist wouldn't have noticed those cavities. I suppose it's possible that that second dentist was lying and actually giving me cavities when I didn't need them. But I didn't get that sense. So I got what it's led me to think about salvia and maybe all-powerful psychedelics is that because they speed up consciousness, in a sense they speed up time. I think they release energy in the body, a kundalini energy, or however you want to describe that, and so we get flooded with that release of energy into our conscious minds, and then it's a question of how much can we process it during that very brief period of time in which it's being released. Of course, most of it we can't. It's just too much. It's an overload. So a lot of that energy just gets lost. It's this big explosion, and that energy is coming from the body. I think it's energy that's being tapped in the cells of the body, and so it's as if we've actually, when we smoke salvia or DMT, it's as if we actually literally take a trip to another dimension, and encounter the, realities and the energies therein, and then we return to our regular time stream with a certain amount of memory of those experiences. But it's like a trip to fairyland. You could go to fairyland, you think you've only been there a day, and you come back and everyone you know is dead, and 100 years have gone
I
by.
think I think in one of my postings, the way I write at my blog is instead of doing kind of lots of short posts, which is the usual blogging method and what it's really all about, I really use my blog as a website and put one or two larger pieces on a month. And one of them recently has dealt with the theme of temporality. And I have this kind of shorthand for various things which might pop out during this discussion, but one of them is the 3D and the 4D, this being the 3D world, and the 4D being where you were introduced to through altered states. And the way I see it, that when you're in the 3D, you are in the temporal, you are in time, in the linear, and the physical manifestation, the density undergoes the apparent process of change over that period of time. And because consciousness is expressed locally, one goes along with that linear thing along the train track from birth to death. When the mind exits that, naturally during sleep at night, where I believe DMT flashes are probably quite a natural occurrence, and as anybody who kind of follows this stuff will be aware that DMT is pretty naturally occurring all over the place. The difference with sleep, however, is that anamnesic response is elicited to necessarily correspond consciousness back with bodily manifestation. Whereas if you take a forced infusion, shall we say, and you imbibe something like DMT or salvia, then you are throwing the consciousness into this fourth dimensional space that is outside of time, is atemporal, if you like. And the life of the individual is almost visitable in its entirety as a shape that you could fly around and you can look at, and it's it's infused with many other shapes and many other dimensions. So effectively, as you say, it's a bit like the kind of sci-fi paradox where you leave the Earth, so consciousness leaves the planet, goes out, and when it comes back, everyone you know is dead. That's because your consciousness sped up so much, and of course this involves your own physical manifestation. So deterioration of the organic form is fascinating, your story. I'm not surprised by that at all. And there's evidence in some of the more daring psychonauts like McKenna and maybe even Bill Hicks, who was quite a heavy user, I believe, that it does impede harmony within the body. So although the intellects and the psyches and the spirits were strong and attractive and amazing, their own dissonance, if you like, is a result of not being able to harmonize the two experiences. So I'm sure there are people on the planet maybe tucked away and speaking languages we're not familiar with who know how to do that. So it's not something to be undertaken lightly. And I think that their relative difficulty to obtain of these things is not a terrible thing, because if you want to do it, you'll get it, and you're not going to really get into any trouble unless you start being commercial about it. But if you're just doing it for personal use, you'll find it. If it's not for you, it's quite difficult to find, and certainly it's not recreational salvia. So I can't imagine how that might find its way onto high school campuses and stuff. It's just a joke.
So, do you think that the entheogens, psychedelics, and all the rest, do you think that they are, and clearly we're agreed that they're tools for consciousness exploration, but I think that a lot of people, even people who use them shamanically, or at least are attempting to, see them as shortcuts or ways to accelerate mutation of consciousness or such like. And what do you think about that?
Yeah, well, if we go back to a metaphor again, I'm pretty visual, so hopefully the people who listen to this are too. I suppose it's a bit like saying, okay, I want to go from here to over there, over the other side of that mountain, and I can either walk, which will take a long time, but I'll see lots of things and I'll develop a sense of the journey, which is, the traditional path of inner transformation and the, time trodden tradition. Or you can use this psychedelic, which is next to you, which is essentially a rocket pack. Put that on your back and fire yourself off into the air with a distinct possibility that you might just crash into the side of the mountain. So it's a risk. It's a risk. If you're used to doing the journey on foot, then you can handle the rocket pack. There seems to be a correlation, I would say. If you've never done the journey on foot, you shouldn't touch the rocket pack.
Well, it's an interesting analogy because it is a shortcut then to the top of the mountain, as you put it. But on the other hand,
Yes, it is.
all you're getting the view from the mountain, but you're not really getting an experience of the mountain. So although you get to the top of the
That's right.
mountain,
It's kind of, if you've not sort of seen the ground and you've not seen the incline and you don't have the perspective, the fact that you're on top of the mountain loses its significance because there's nothing to contrast it against.
yeah, you don't even know how you got there, and you may not know how to get down, which of course is a lot of experience that people have on psychedelics. They get to this state and they're not ready to process it, even if it's a positive experience. They can't deal with the coming back to reality. I mean, this is personally speaking, I've spent quite a few years exploring my own psyche using power plants and whatnot. I thought shamanically, and I think relatively speaking, I was being responsible, but it's very difficult to, unless you actually have a guide then the chances of ego inflation are enormous, I think, because you take your personal consciousness into these realms and you start seeing other worlds and other possibilities, and then you bring that experience back to your everyday life and you feel empowered by that, you feel liberated. And I think, again, speaking personally, that was quite illusory because I didn't know how I got to the top of the mountain, and I hadn't learned about mountain climbing. I hadn't actually learned about how to shape my own awareness. I'd simply learned, discovered new levels of awareness, and that, and then I wanted to get back to them, and I didn't know how, is the thing, except by doing more psychedelics, which my body let me know pretty quickly. I couldn't simply carry on using them to get to the top of that mountain. It was like, now I know where the mountain top is or what it's like up there. Now I've got to figure out, I've got to get my tools and my pack and actually start climbing the damn mountain.
Yeah, this is to some extent in my reflection what Castaneda called the third enemy of the sorcerer, which is power. So when you get the sense of these things and you're able to move in a way that other humans are not able to move, integrating that power and that ability into your life is no mean feat.
Yeah, well, it's I also see it as like paying taxes, is that when you take a sh apparent shortcut, or you fly over, all these boundaries, these borders to get to the promised land of heightened awareness, you have bypassed the toll booths that normally you would have to, make your offering, like crossing the Styx, going into Hades, you've got to pay the ferryman.
Yes.
And so you use psychedelics, you bypass all that, and so then when you come back to the place you were when you started, and then you've got to start making your own way, then you encounter these checkpoints, if you will, and it's like then you've got to pay the back tax. So we remember you're the one who flew over back in 2001, now we've got you, and that's sort of been my experience of putting it in poetic terms, is that it's been a lot harder just to live like a regular person and just get on with the nitty-gritty of life because I've had these experiences, and I feel that I now have to pay for them after the fact. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, we can only hope that we don't end up like Cypher in the Matrix, who chooses that the real world is too painful after what he's seen, and he wants to go back into the illusory horseshit to eat his fake steak and drink his fake wine.
Have you ever felt like that?
No.
I've had that. I have felt like that. Unfortunately, and I think this is probably the rule for psychonauts, by the time I realized that I probably should have taken the blue pill, it was too late. It wasn't available anymore.
I think it's natural for everybody to kind of sit back and think, why can't I just be a barbecue and football kind of person? But once you've gone on a journey, the pleasures and the distractions that those things offer are so puny, so pathetic, that even if you do have a weak evening one time and think of those things, literally hours later those get swept away in again in the adventure. So there seems again to be a mystical tradition of hardening the psyche and the soul. So whichever way you look at this, my pretty early on teenage summation of things, that Earth is essentially a training ground, is not that different today.
So, what do you mean when you say hardening the psyche and the soul? Like making it resistant?
Well, yeah, making it resilient and self-sustaining, expansive rather than contracting. So usually, if you take two kind of drunken fighters in the street who spill out of a bar, the bodies are contracted and everything is tight and everything is coiled. Whereas if you watch a martial artist, the first thing they do is release that and get rid of that and expand and relax. And I think the human fear tendency makes people contract, and the spiritual journey teaches expansion, and it's quite a tricky thing. It takes many years to get into that. So the expansion process may take, who knows, 100 lives to start to gather together the necessary skills to do it naturally.
But wouldn't that be a softening? then of the psyche? You talk about martial arts. I mean, the real power is in
Sure, yeah.
flexibility, isn't it? And openness.
From the consensus point of view, it's a hardening. From our point of view, dare I say, it is indeed a softening. Yeah, you're quite right.
Okay, well, let's press on, because I know that you and I between us could spend the whole show, even if it's a 2 hour show, just talking about psychedelics, and we don't
How many
want to do
questions
that.
are there, by the way?
Well, there's 64, as you know, so but you can we're not going to get
So how
through
many in
64.
my section?
Oh, as many as you like or as few as we like. I mean, if
Right.
you yeah.
It's at this rate, it's going to be an hour a question, but it's whether we do two and it's 2 good hours, that'll do me.
Well, as I say, they're questions. I've tried to make questions that are subjects unto themselves, and we could easily spend a whole show talking about any of these. But and I'd be quite happy to talk with you about psychedelics the whole time. But I think that
Yeah.
probably our listeners would be curious to hear your take on other stuff.
Let's move on, yeah.
Okay, new number between 1 and 64.
39.
Okay, that's 3 times 13 is 39, and that is creative imagination an active part of your work, and how?
Again, yes. I think it has to be. Again, I've kind of got some writing I sort of constructed on this, where I went back and looked at who arguably are some of the most creative people and musicians and artists and so on, who the creative process is very, very essential, whereas we can slip back into the comfortable slippers of sort of academic approach from time to time. If you're a painter, you can't really do that. It's just creative juice or death, really. And when you look at the people who really excel in what they do, they seem to have this channel open all the time, what I call uplink. And that's the creative process. And without that, things lack color and they lack grace and they lack elegance and they lack spark. So, I'm pretty critical of hardcore conspiracy types who just moan on and on about how shit everything is and how everything's controlled and there's nothing we can do about it. It simply isn't true. It's a stage, and without the necessary creative field uplink, I think it's very difficult to go past the obstacle of the conspiracy or the obstacle of what I call the control system. So creativity is a key bit. So, I can envisage one day, within the alternative movement, you'll have kind of rehabilitation centers for people who've got stuck in the conspiracy, and they'll be having painting classes, doing watercolors outside just to loosen that muscle up again, you know?
Right. Well, yeah, this is definitely an area that I mean, I've also experienced the frustration that you're describing with other researchers, and this insistence always on a nuts and bolts view, and not necessarily literally a nuts and bolt view. It might
Yeah, that's it, yeah.
be a more subtle kind of nuts and bolts thing, where everything has to be somehow shoehorned into consensus reality as we know it. Even though to me the essence of these investigations and researches is to lead us to the rabbit hole, and then to go down the rabbit hole, and to use whatever it is, discoveries of conspiracies or UFO activity or occult systems, all the rest of it, to provide or to discover a new context by which to experience this reality. And
I think one central point, sorry to interrupt, one
yeah.
central point is that the individuation of the journey of the unfoldment of the discovery is quite a trap in itself. And one of the things that I caught from Jake's interview with you was his view on, the enemy being an aspect of self, which is a very fundamental part of my way of looking at things. And I think that almost exclusively when you name names, which I won't do here, but I'm sorely tempted from time to time, of big name people who are really mired in the conspiracy and are quite good at producing facts and figures, But when you listen to them, they take energy from you. They never ever give. They never ever create. They just take energy and they draw it from you. And it's kind of unconsciously vampiric. And those people all have one thing in common, which is they have no sense of oneness, no belief in the connectedness of things, no experience of it, more importantly. And again, I think it's a side road that one goes down and then you forget how to get back again. So it's something that you need to take a look at, you need to visit, you need to immerse yourself in even. But once you've done that, kind of like Robert Anton Wilson style, you need to then extract yourself from it and remember what you were doing when you first started, which was just looking at that, yeah? Because there's other things to look at too.
Yeah, well, Robert Anton Wilson seems a very good example of what I'm talking about and what's behind this question, because he always made it very clear that he was creating narratives in the process of investigating narratives that already exist. It's like a gonzo occultism is a term that I use, and I've attempted to do the same with my work. And to it's similar to something that Oliver Stone said about his movie JFK. Not that I'm a fan of Oliver Stone, by the way, but I think it was valid. He made a valid observation about what he was doing there. Was he said that the Warren Report was a myth. In the profane sense, a lie, a misinformation,
yes,
a fabrication, a false narrative, and so he was simply creating an alternate myth to juxtapose with that myth, and I think that it's valid, because if you're going to investigate the JFK assassination, for example, and try and turn it into a narrative, there's no way to avoid filling in the gaps with imaginative thinking, because we simply don't have all the information. So we actually have to weave a narrative just to pull all the strands together. And so the looser and more flexible and more open we can keep that narrative, in other words, the more we allow the mythical, the fictional element to be present and to be obvious, as it was in Wilson's work, the freer both the reader and the researcher is to kind of integrate that with their own personal myth.
Yeah, I think I observe that too, yeah. I think there's a tendency early on that when you encounter these things, you want to pin it down to your current ability to put this within a linear narrative, as you put it. And by the sheer nature of the journey, when you start off, your narrative is going to be one-dimensional. And as you start to uncover things, you are tempted and deceived, self-deceived, to fit those pins into the narrative that you started off with, whereas you should extract that to some extent and have it loose in the background with, you know, plot points and plot turns and plot twists. But the story is being written very much as it goes along, like that fantasy story, never-ending story with the blank book. Jekyll probably quite like things like that, but you know, the story imagines itself into existence, and the interdependency of the reader and the read are obviously apparent.
Yeah, and this is, I mean, quantum mechanics is allowing this concept to filter down into consensus reality, into our interpretation system, but
yeah,
it's still
absolutely.
a long way, isn't it? And generally the assumption is for all of us, you know, even those of us who are attempting to create our own perspective, our own interpretation systems, the idea that consensus reality is fixed is almost unshakable. It's almost unescapable, this sense that events are what they are, and if they happen, there can only be one version of events. You know, that history is history, and somehow it's fixed like a block of ice. I use the metaphor block of ice because to suggest that it isn't fixed, but it gives us the impression that it is fixed. The block of ice seems as solid, as rock hard, and as impenetrable as an actual rock, but of course change the temperature and that block of ice starts to melt, and then we can actually see that it can change form.
Yeah, nice image. Yeah,
and actually become not only change form but become a different medium entirely, because ice is actually water and then potentially even steam. And this is a model that it's actually just the first time I've tried to express it, because I was planning to do a show around this, but that the past is a block of ice, the present is the flow, is the stream, and the future is steam. And so this is like an evolution of consciousness, that we're kind of stuck in the past in this view that everything is fixed, is this ice, that we can chip away at it and change the form that way, but that's a lot of work, and that essentially we just have to deal with the ice. But if we can change the temperature, which is to say the frequency of our consciousness, then we begin to melt that block. We begin to let go of this idea that history or reality is this fixed objective entity, and then we begin to observe a flow. And then we're with the flow, and then we can actually move potentially into the third state, which is this future, which is where I think free will comes into it, where steam is actually, see, flow, at least unlike ice, it's actually moving, it's alive, but it's still fixed, isn't it? The flow has to go where it flows. A river is fixed to the confines of the river. Whereas when, if we go into the steam state, then we're actually, then we become completely liberated. We become a different element entirely. It moves into air. So yeah, this sort of model that, as I say, I've just working out right now as I'm talking to you, but of these different states of consciousness, from ice, which is matter, which is solid like mineral rock, to flow, which is water, and then to steam, which is air. And how we're, how we relate, what relationship we have with our reality, is determined by this, the kind of consciousness that we bring to experience.
Yeah, I think your model describes the kind of movement and flow of energy really well, and it's as I said before, it suits me because that's those are little bookmarks for thought, aren't they? When you have an image, because we are very visual despite other things, that's the way we go. I also have an image just to kind of transpose with that one. My initial feelings about kind of determinism and free will and fatalism and all the rest of it was, going back a long time when I started my inner journey, say in my teens, I was horrified at the idea that there would be no free will, and I was horrified at the idea that everything is predetermined. As I've gone through my own discoveries and investigations, and as I've learned to make the ego recede and be more humble and see things as they are, I realized that the horror of an anti-free will environment was for me an egoic response. The way I see it is that there's this kind of enormous map that you lay out across your living room floor, with a zillion things on it, real sort of Middle Earth mega map. And there is a laser that points down, and the laser draws a path from one corner of the map to the other, which represents your life. And where you are at any one moment is the laser, so the consciousness that you reflect into yourself, that you bring locally, is projected into your journey, your path. So your life is better described, as I'm sure a lot of people gather nowadays, as a collection of experiences rather than as an identity, because that can be stripped away pretty rapidly. So if you look backwards, you can see that the laser has burnt, a black line through the map, and it seems pretty, permanent, and you can't do too much about that. That's where you've come from. And as you look forward, it seems indeterminate. But it's only from the point of the laser that comes down, which we can say, where does that come from? It comes from a larger entity. But we're just dealing with the point of the laser as it reaches the map, which is the individuation of consciousness. Now, if you step outside of the map, if you can look down on it, which is the four-dimensional perspective, and I use 4D, kind of a little lightheartedly, not in a necessarily quantum sense, because there are 9D and 12D stack models. I'm not referring to that. I mean it in a more kind of mystical tradition. If you get off the map and go into the 4D and look down upon it, then suddenly you realize that the map exists, and all routes on the map exist. And if your perspective is high enough, you can see everything and you can predict everything because you've got to go on the map, yeah? But the sort of neuron routes, just like the pathways in the brain, are so immense, so humongous, that it is as good as free will. And there's so little difference that from the perspective of the laser that is moving, it is free will. Only from an extremely high perspective and only from outside of the temporal space can we see that in fact it isn't. It is a determinable path across a fixed map, but the map cannot be seen when in the three-dimensional space. There's almost like some kind of universal law that says if you see the map, if you come up and look down on it, you know it's gonna impede your journey. Even though it's nice to get up on the mountain and look down and go, ha ha, now I can see the landscape.
Right.
As we've already covered in this, there's a penalty to pay for that, which is, you know, a temporal impact, which takes its toll on your body or your mind or your physiology or whatever.
So it's almost like the illusion of free will, of autonomy, is necessary for the components of the system to operate within the
Yeah, that's right.
system.
Yeah, because if all the little units walking around the matrix knew they were just in a pod having a shit time in actuality, then they'd lose heart somewhat. So the fact that free will is so abundant and so readily available to everybody, and as I say, it is as good as, if the sort of purpose of mankind is to explore free will, then it's almost like kind of philosophical semantics to say, well, is that free will or is it not? And from my point of view, it just depends on how high you can get above the map. So if there is a supreme creative being, which, you know, there often seems to be in my world, I can see his traces from here and there, although he isn't a he. As I think Robert Anton Wilson said, it's so strange to think of a creative divine entity with a penis. So let's call it it. So it looks down from high on the map, and my little laser point moving along is so different that there's just nothing in between as far as that entity is concerned. So we can't shift back into from the 3D to philosophize this. It's like a psychedelic journey. It's too state specific, too belonging to the 4D to bring back and put in any kind of linguistic framework. It's just too weird.
Yeah, it's almost too weird for me to have an answer to. That seemed like as good a place as any to stop this section. We'll pick up the rest of this chat a few days from now in part two of this interview. Once again, encouraging you to visit the blog www.aeoluskephas.blogspot.com and in the process of setting up a forum and my own website aeoluskephas.com that should be up within a week or so. In the meantime, go to the blog, check the links, buy my book, you bastards, keep me in business in these the final days. Signing off, Aeolus Cephas, stormy weather, news from the front line in the end times.